Welcome back, Gathering Church, to another installment of our Missional Living series. My family spent some time away last week, that's why I wasn't here. We got to go to a little trailer by the beach back in the Niagara region. We spent a week just kind of huddled in a little trailer together as family, reconnecting, having great times. There was beautiful weather. There was the beach all to ourselves because all the other kids were still in school. And then there was the World Cup, the start of the World Cup. So if you cheer for Brazil, Germany, or this morning England, you're probably in a pretty good mood. You had a great week. So we're glad that you're happy with us. But, this feeling of coming back, I really appreciate our time away. We like vacating and getting out. But then it's great to come back home. Great to be back with the church family, and then great to be back to finish this Missional Living series. I'm excited to wrap this up this morning. I hope this series has you thinking about your everyday walking around life, about being an extension of Christ's mission here on earth, that you are, in reality, a called, sent, and empowered missionary. Empowered when we're connected to Christ, who is our bread, our water, and our light. We're called to reflect to others the truth about God as we ourselves remain connected to that truth. And then we're sent. Last week, Catherine shared that we are sent to serve, that serving missionally will mean that we're on the lookout for ways to bless, to serve, to be sacrificial. And this Sunday, we complete this four-part series with missional living and community, which will speak about Jesus' strategy to organize us together in missional communities, to orient us towards one another. We're not asked to go it alone. We're not asked to figure it out on our own, to hear the voice of the Spirit alone. We're called into community, and it's expected that we will live our missional lives all wrapped up and entwined with one another. That we who are called a body by Paul would grow up together into a healthy, fully functional, fully gifted missional outpost to those who need the good news of the gospel in our world. It might seem like a given that the church understands that this is God's strategy, community, but I'm not so sure of that. I think there's very good reasons that the word community gets thrown around so much in church circles. Everyone's talking about community. I think there's a great reason for that, because our culture tends to hammer out the other side of it, the individualistic messages, because we like believing that we can do it all, that we are islands of self-sufficiency. Have it your way, Subway says. Think different. Be your own little individualized thinker, Apple tells us. You do you is a popular phrase that the kids tell themselves and each other. When someone's trying to get them to conform, they say, no, you do you, man. Do it your own way. Self-identify as a monkey, if you want, which is this new next evolution of self-identifying and being your own autonomous person. The ego, the part of our mind that tells us, if you don't know about that self-identify as a monkey, go look it up. It's fascinating reading. The ego, the part of our mind that tells us that we are important, is attracted to messages that build us up, that puff us up. This can quickly become the church of me, myself, and I when we bring that idea into the church. It might finally have the corner on the truth, that's true, but the potlucks will be a tad dry and boring. I believe it's incredibly important for the church to communicate passionately and demonstrate powerfully the presence of Christ in the gathered community. Although the disciples were individuals, they were often wrapped up in their own agendas. Jesus consistently teaches and models for them a missional life through community. As he was discipling his disciples, he would regularly confront their individualism. Whenever he noticed it, whenever it popped up, he would confront it. He exposes their vain pursuits and their heart motivations and reorients them back towards one another. He does this in lots of different ways. He was concerned that their actions were motivated not by achievement, not by personal success, but by their love and care for one another. So I have a few examples of the disciples' individualistic concerns and then how Jesus corrects them. First, the disciples return rejoicing over what they've accomplished. So Jesus sends them out, and they come back, and things went really well. They had some great success. The 72 return with joy and say, "Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. They've tasted power. They can cast out demons." And here's what Jesus replies. He says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. I've given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions, to overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing will harm you. However, do not rejoice that the spirits submit to you." Interesting. Don't rejoice in that. But rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Your names are written in heaven. So that's what Jesus wants them to focus on. Not the success they've had in their ministry, but that we are all here together with our names written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Seeing a potential for personal pride and power taking hold of his disciples because they've been successful, Jesus reorients them back to their communal joy of being kingdom citizens together. A second example. James and John come to Jesus and they say, we want you to give us whatever we ask. And Jesus says, well, what do you ask? And they say, let us sit at your right and your left hand when you come into glory. And here's how Jesus responds to them. He basically says, you see how the Gentiles, those in power, lord it over the people under them. He says, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be the servant, the slave of all. A third instance, Jesus has just said to the disciples that he's going to go and suffer. He's going to be caught. He's going to be crucified. And Peter pipes up and says, this shall never happen to you. We know this one. Jesus says, you do not have in mind the concerns of God, but the concerns of man. Jesus reorients Peter because Peter is saying, this bad thing can never happen to you. You need to be exalted. You need to take your place as the king, the ruler of this world. And Jesus reorients Peter to say, you don't have you don't have in mind the concerns of God, but the concerns of man. Jesus' greatest affirmation of community was in giving his life away for the many. He says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. His most powerful, passionate, embodied lesson to us. And then later on, Peter asked Jesus, they were kind of walking on the beach together. Jesus says, just talks about Peter, how Peter's going to die. He's going to be martyred. And Peter's, I don't know how he's feeling about that. I don't know how I would feel about Jesus telling me how I'm about to die for him. But here's what Peter says. He says, what's going to happen to him? So he points to John. He says, what about him? I'm not sure what Peter's tone would have been. It would have been like, are you kidding? Like, what about that guy? What about John? Does he have to die too? Or it would be like, well, it could have been the other way. Like, oh, I get to die a glorious death. Does he get the same privilege? Does he get the same rights? Or do I get a better death than John? I don't know what he's thinking. And Jesus answered, this is why I think one of those two things, because he answers, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you, Peter? You must follow me. So once again, a reorientation. Peter's worried about how he's stacking up against John. And Jesus is saying, you let me worry about John. You worry about your own heart, your own relationship. So it's a reorientation away from the individual, away from the self, and back into community. Stop thinking about place and position, personal honor and achievement. And beyond these moments of corrective reorientation, Jesus models and teaches a communal approach to missional living in several active ways. And this leads us to realize that we are formed not for ourselves only, but rather we are formed in community and for community. The first, Jesus calls the disciples to follow him. So Jesus has just been baptized. He's gone through the desert and been tempted. He preaches this announcement that repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And then the very next thing he does is this. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net to the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me, and I will send you out to fish for people." At once they leave their nets and follow him. Going on from there, he sees two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in the boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. So this is his first move. His strategic organization is to form a community of disciples who would then learn how to become disciple makers. Disciple those who will make disciples. Disciple disciples. That's the strategy. And then later we see that Jesus sends his disciples out two by two. He does this on two different occasions. First with the apostles, the 12 apostles, he divides them up two by two and sends them out. And then with the 72, he sends them out two by two. So calling the 12, he began to send them out two by two, gave them authority over impure spirits. And then in Luke 10, after this, the Lord appointed 72, some translations say 70, if that's what you're used to hearing, and send them two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he was about to go. So his method of discipleship, of training his disciples how to make disciples, is that they would go out together. They would go out two by two, never alone. And this method has so much wisdom when we think about it. A few things that off the top of my head I think of is support. Ecclesiastes 4 has this great stuff where it talks about how two are better than one. It's a beautiful wedding passage if you're looking for a unique one. But Ecclesiastes 4 talks about two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. So it's this call to community, that we're better together. So that's support. There's also counsel. Proverbs 15:22, plans fail for lack of counsel, but with many advisors they succeed. So two heads are better than one. And then gift mix. 1 Corinthians 12 talks about how each one is given a manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Not for themselves, but for the common good. To one there is given one gift, and to another another. So when you have a community, even if it's just two, you have more gifts at your disposal, more gifts to employ in the mission. So that's the second thing he does. He sends them out two by two. So as they're learning how to do this, they're in community. A third is that he gathers around the table. He gathers around the table to teach and to show, to demonstrate, be it in a stranger's home or among 5,000 on a hillside. So Luke 19 has this interesting story of Zacchaeus. It says, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So Zacchaeus comes down at once and welcomes him gladly. And around this table, something happens where Zacchaeus actually has a transformation around the table. He repents of his sins. He promises to reconcile with those he's wronged. And he promises to serve the poor. And then Jesus declares that salvation has come to Zacchaeus? No. He actually says salvation has come to this household. So once again, Jesus is saying, this is about community, Zacchaeus. This transformation you've had is actually going to be a salvation event for your entire household. At the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus directs them to have the people sit in groups on the grass. So I don't know if we've thought about that, but this feeding of the 5,000 miracle was a shared meal. It was a shared miracle because God's blessings are to be shared, eye to eye, face to face, life to life. So Jesus models table ministry as an expression of relationship. There's something about hospitality around the table that fills so many of our interpersonal needs. You get eye contact. You feel filled physically. Sometimes you get a little high if you're eating certain foods. You feel full, you feel good, you feel joyous. You're conversing, you're exchanging ideas. You're knowing and being known. You're learning, you're disagreeing maybe. You're teaching, you're listening. And perhaps the most important, you're making room for someone else. Making room at your table, you're making room in conversation. Jesus calls the disciples to this table fellowship. And he calls the disciples to be defined by their love for one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. So what he doesn't say here is they're not going to know by your personal spiritual superiority. They're not going to know by your healing powers. They're not going to know by your ability to quote verses at them. But by the love that they feel present in the community, in your community. That's how people will know that you are Jesus' disciples. And then an interesting thing is, it works. So often we expect the disciples to mess it up, but they get this right. So Jesus' teaching and modeling are embraced and carried out in the early church. The post-resurrection church, so Jesus has been resurrected and gone back to the right hand of the Father, and then we observe in Acts the church doing this very thing, holding things in common in Acts 2. So they had their physical possessions and they held it in common because the value was for the community. We want to serve and make sure everyone has enough. Paul and Barnabas sent out two by two, the exact same model that Jesus had started. When they're making big decisions about how we're going to be the church together, how is this early church going to work, they hold a council called the Council at Jerusalem. And the apostles, the elders, and the whole church is welcomed and their voices are heard. And the strategy that Paul employs is house churches, setting up little missional outposts, little communities all over where he preaches the news and he orients them towards one another. Be a community. Be a community. So I want to say this, just a little caveat here, and that's that this orientation toward community doesn't devalue you as an individual, doesn't devalue your individual contributions and gifts. So it's not saying that, it's not like the Borg if you're a Star Trek fan where you have no more identity and you're just one of the mass. Some people got that, okay. The rest, don't worry. So it's just that our individual gifts are not used to distinguish honor. In fact, Paul reverses that idea for us. In 1 Corinthians 12, when he's teaching about the gifts, he says, on the contrary, those parts of the body, the community, that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. So why does Paul say this? He's trying to get us to think differently about honor, about hierarchy, about who's to be respected in the community and who's not. Basically, I hear him saying this. If you're still playing the hierarchy game, the who's first, the who's best game, then try this. Think of the person that you think is deserving of the least honor and respect in the community and start to treat them as if they are the person deserving the highest respect and honor and see if that doesn't mess with your idea of hierarchy, of respect, of how God's community is intending to be formed. That'll challenge us. If we just try and follow Paul's recommendation there of trying to treat the least as the greatest, that will mess our minds up about how we think about hierarchy, who's got it all together and who doesn't. I think that's a pretty strong challenge that Paul offers the church. So Jesus Christ leaves the church with a vision to be and do together, to live out the way of Christ in community, where we're given equal concern for each other, where we each have a part to play, and where we rejoice in the good work as one. I love having Rachel be recognized, the kids coming up and playing a part in our worship, where the kids' voices and the kids handing a gift is this visual picture about how we care for one another and everyone plays a part. Now I invite you to consider this table that we've set this morning. I like the table as a helpful metaphor for our missional living and community. It reminds us of communion. So we've got the bread, we've got the cup. That need that all of this only works when we're connected to Christ, when we're sustained by Christ. But at the same time, it reminds us that we don't practice communion alone, that the table set for one seems wrong, it seems incomplete. It seems like, well, that's not the way we do communion. We share. We need other people to be involved. The shared life becomes a very tangible, practical way to experience the Father's bounty, to taste and see that he is faithful, just, generous, and for us. And all are welcome at the table. As the chorus of that song we sung just before I started speaking, lay down your burdens, lay down your shame. All who are broken, lift up your face. Wanderer, come home, you're not too far. Lay down your hurt, lay down your heart, and come as you are. The invitation to the table is to come as you are. Come as you are. So how might we respond to the invitation to missional life and community to the table? Well, the first is that we have to take the brave step away from our self-individualistic life and sit down at the table of community, to sit down with others, to look at people eye to eye and face to face. Maybe that's why that song says you've got to lay down your hurt, you've got to lay down your brokenness, you've got to lay down the ways that you're separating yourself from others. You've got to sit down at the table. And this can feel like a big first step, to trust others to care for you, to support you, to understand and accept you. But the risk, we find, is worth it. When that trust is returned, when you begin to experience the manifold blessings of life with one another and for one another, in this, we are with God, because He is like this. He trusts. He gives. He exists in community. So have you risked community? If you're listening to my voice, have you risked community? Are you still on the outside, peering in the windows, checking it out, kicking the tires? I encourage you to take a step towards community, be it one person, letting someone else in, a group, or us as a church family. Take a step towards us. A second response is that we invite others to join us at the table. Come as you are. How have I seen this done? Well, I know there's a gentleman in our congregation who's regularly, consistently inviting his friends, his neighbors, people he meets to community suppers and to our church. I see it when a new attender's daughter invites a friend the very next week to join in Sunday school fun. It also happens in gentle, well-meaning accountability conversations. Maybe I get more of these than you do, I don't know. But one of the ones that I think of is some comments. When we plan events together, if we're going to plan something as a church family, let's consider our location. Let's make sure there are as few barriers to attending as possible. Make sure that everyone who wants to go can go. What a beautiful corrective, what a beautiful encouragement that when we're thinking about things as a church, let's be as open and inviting as possible. So who have you been encouraging with your words and actions that there is room at the table for them? There's room here. Who's on your mind? Who's on your heart? Who could use an invitation to God's table grace? And then the third, we invite others to our table, to our tables, to learn and practice this way together. We're called to do it together, not alone. And we begin to do that by a very simple first step, although it's very difficult for us, to invite someone else to join us, to get to know us, to get close enough to see us. A small group is a wonderful time-tested example of this. Inviting people into our homes to practice and learn together how to make our faith a bigger part of our lives. So how have we heard this being done? Well, I've asked Julie to come up and share a little bit about this. Come on up, Julie. We have several small groups, and we're working on adding a couple more. It's just right there. And I just encourage you, this is a very practical way that you can take a step into community, and you can be invited to someone's table to learn. So, just a couple of questions for you, Julie. I didn't write them down, but I hope I can remember from the ones I asked you. the first is, why hadn't you joined a small group? So what, you know, you did join one, so we're getting there. But why, what kind of prevented you from joining a small group, or how did that whole process happen?
Yeah, so for those of you that don't know me and Dylan as well, our schedules, as of right now, are polar opposite. So I have a very typical 9-to-5 job, and Dylan is a more 12-to-9 in the evening job. So for us, even just logistically, it was really hard. So that was kind of just one thing that was a little bit more difficult for us. But we, together, also felt like we didn't want to join an existing group and be that outsider couple. We were really nervous about that. so we just felt as though it was a little bit more intimidating. And then we also didn't feel as though we, or I guess not feel, but we were a little bit more nervous that we might also be joining a group that was at a different faith level than us. We are short into our marriage and still learning together as a couple as well as individuals, so we felt as though joining a group might be a little bit scary in the sense of who we were matched with, per se, and feeling like we might be coming into a group that has been learning together a really long time and just feeling like we might have been at different points in our faith journeys together. So, yeah, a little bit.
Nervous. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
I want her to share that because there's lots of reasons why we wouldn't do something. And I hope that you heard, thank you for sharing that vulnerability and honesty, that that's probably stuff that we all struggle with and wrestle with. There's always a cost to taking a step into community. So we recognize the cost. But then you decided. Why did you decide?
So yeah, we joined Mike and Megan's small group and have loved every minute of it. But really, we just decided that we needed that. We needed to take that extra step outside of just chatting with each other and kind of doing our own self-reflection after every Sunday. We were finding that we were getting home and we had been chatting about the sermon and we're only seeing it from two perspectives and weren't really finding that was challenging enough for us, and we really wanted to see how others were taking the message and taking the sermon and even just their experience at church and kind of branching out outside of that. So we felt like we needed that extra kind of I guess you could call it. And we also felt like it would be a really good opportunity for us as a couple and as individuals to have a bigger support team in our faith. So not just leaning on each other, and which is great. I really love you. but yeah, just feeling like it would have really enhanced our faith and really given us a new challenge to grow with others who see the same things or even see different things, and felt like that was a really good decision to make. So,
fantastic. Yeah. And how has it worked?
We love it. it has been so rewarding. We love everybody in our small group, and we've made some really great friends. We feel supported in that, and we feel as though we challenge each other in different ways. We are seeing those new perspectives. A few of us have grown up not in the Mennonite background, so it's a little bit even different seeing it from a different family perspective. We also just are listening in different ways, so not just learning in different ways, but feeling like we're hearing each other, so that's been really encouraging. And the other thing is that Dylan and I are now finding that we are taking more time as a couple to really engage with each other outside of just our Sunday conversations, and are engaging each other at home, despite our time differences, outside of small group too. So that's been something else that we're learning together. And then the other thing, we just were talking about, we feel really validated when we have our small group. We feel as though the things that we are struggling with, faith-wise and even just like marriage-wise and life-wise, we feel as though we have a really great support group for that. Praying together has been really just like really deep and meaningful for us as well. So we just feel like we can share our joys, and we can also share our fears and our just kind of outlook in general with our small group, and feel like that's really rewarding. So, yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much,
yeah,
Julie.
Thanks.
Thank you for her time. So this idea of a small group, of orienting to each other, is, like I said, a time-tested strategy. The early churches were house churches, and we try to model this. We try to offer different groups. But if, you know, maybe you're listening, you're like, wow, that doesn't work for me because, and you have some of those valid concerns that you think you can't get around, please let Catherine and I know. We want to hear about the things that are stopping people from taking steps toward community. And if it's within our power and ability, we will do our very best to start to work on those things. Another way to do this, so small groups is one. Another one that I wanted to highlight for us is mentors and spiritual friends. Co-journeyers, you might say. It happens really powerfully, this communal orientation, when we invite even one person to intentionally walk closely with us. Mentor, mentee, or spiritual friendships. This is someone who's regularly responsible for you and you for them. A mutual sharing and caring. It's more personal, and it's incredibly encouraging. I know many of you are experiencing the blessing of these kind of micro-community relationships, and you'll probably know that Jim actually filled that role for me at a season of my life where I was coming new into the Mennonite family and learning about what it is to be a Mennonite, what it is to be a pastor in a Mennonite context. He journeyed close with me. He took the time to ask good questions, and he answered mine. And look where that led. Sometimes these relationships open new opportunities and new doorways that you're not really sure you wouldn't have seen at the outset. So the question for us is, who has been invited to your table? To taste and see that God is good from your life, from the way you are reflecting the Father in truth and love. Who's journeying with you to get close enough to challenge you, close enough to care? So two things. Either ask God for someone, if there's no one that you can think of, and I do believe he will respond. Or thank God for them, if you know who it is. Just even now, just thank God for that person. They are a gift to you. So if you're feeling a stirring in your spirit on any of these challenges, any of these questions I put out to you this morning, we want to pray with you. We want to be an extension of community for you this morning. So feel free to come forward at the end of service. As the band comes up, I'll just close and recap. So living and learning together in community is God's strategy for our everyday missional life. It's how he's organized us. It's the way we do this. We're never asked to go it alone, to figure things out on our own, to hear the voice of the Spirit alone. We're called into community, and it's expected that we will live our missional lives all wrapped up and entwined with one another. That we who are called a body would grow up together into a healthy, fully functional, fully gifted missional outpost to those in the world who are waiting to hear good news. May it be so. Would you pray with me? Father, we thank you for this invitation to community. We thank you that you see that we need one another, that we are not islands unto ourselves. And we pray for those people that you've called to journey with us, those people that you've called to get close enough to care, close enough to know. And Father, if there's no one like that right now, filling that place in our lives, we ask that you would show us who that might be. Drop a name or a couple of names into our heart that we might reach out to, have the courage to sit down at the table, ask them for coffee, ask them for lunch, and say, would you journey with me? We thank you for the challenges this morning. We thank you for the example of communal life. We thank you for our ability to go and practice this at our community barbecue after service. God, thank you for being our life, our inspiration, our sustaining force, and our model. In Jesus' name.